himself. Stewart saved himself by becoming emotionless. Last year, his wife walked out on him. She's had it with his two-dimensional existence. What woman wants to be married to Spock? Alex recently suffered a series of panic attacks that left him almost unable to leave his home. The whole macho construct fell to the ground. At first, nobody could believe it. Alex couldn't believe it. He was invincible, the strongest guy you ever met. But it was all built as a defense against the wound. Our loss doesn't necessarily have to be something so dramatic. A man may simply awaken one day to find himself lost, lost as Dante described himself. In the middle of the road of my life, I awoke in a dark wood where the true way was wholly lost. This was the turning point in my life. I went to Washington, D.C. as a young man to try to make something of myself, to prove something, establish credibility. The damnable thing about it was, I succeeded. My giftedness worked against me by coming through for me. I was recognized and rewarded. But the whole experience felt like an act of survival. Not something flowing out of a deep center, but something I had to prove, overcome, grasp. As Manning said of his own imposter, I studied hard, scored excellent grades, won a scholarship in high school, and was stalked every waking morning by the terror of abandonment and the sense that nobody was there for me. At the end of 2 years, I woke one morning and realized I hated my life. George MacDonald says in Diary of an Old Soul, how many helps thou givest to those who would learn, to some sore pain, to others a sinking heart, to some a weariness worse than any smart, to some a haunting, fearing, blind concern, madness to some the shaking dart, of hideous death still following as they turn, to some a hunger that will not depart, to some thou givest a deep unrest, a scorn of all they are or see upon the earth, a gaze at dusky night and clearing morn, as on a land of emptiness and dearth, to some a bitter sorrow, to some the sting of love misprized, of sick abandoning, to some a frozen heart, oh, worse than anything. The messengers of Satan think to mar, but make, driving the soul from false to feel, to thee the reconciler, the one real, in whom alone the would-be and the is are met. This is a very dangerous moment when God seems set against everything that has meant life to us. Satan spies his opportunity and leaps to accuse God in our hearts. You see, he says, God is angry with you. He's disappointed in you. If he loved you, he would make things smoother. He's not out for your best, you know. The enemy always tempts us back toward control to recover and rebuild the false self. We must remember that it is out of love that God thwarts our imposter. As Hebrews reminds us, it is the Son whom God disciplines. Therefore, do not lose heart. God thwarts us to save us. We think it will destroy us, but the opposite is true. We must be saved from what really will destroy us. If we would walk with him in our journey of masculine initiation, we must walk away from the false self, set it down, give it up willingly. It feels crazy. It feels immensely vulnerable. Brad has stopped looking for the group. Stewart has begun to open up his heart to emotion, to relationship, to all that he buried so long ago. Alex stopped eating glass, stopped the whole macho thing to face what he has never faced inside. I gave up perfectionism, left Washington, and went looking for my heart. We simply accept the invitation to leave all that we've relied on and venture out with God. We can choose to do it ourselves, or we can wait for God to bring it all down. If you have no clue as to what your false self may be, then a starting point would be to ask those you live with and work with, what is my effect on you? What am I like to live with or work with? What don't you feel free to bring up with me? If you never, ever say a word in a meeting because you fear you might say something stupid, well, then it's time to speak up. If all you ever do is dominate a meeting because your sense of worth comes from being in charge, then you need to shut up for a while. If you've run to sports because you feel best about yourself there, then it's probably time to give it a rest and stay home with your family. If you never play any game with other men, and it's time you go down to the gym with the guys and play some hoops. In other words, you face your fears head on. Drop the fig leaf. Come out of hiding. For how long? Longer than you want to. Long enough to raise the deeper issues. Let the wound surface from beneath it all. Losing the false self is painful. Though it's a mask, it's one we've worn for years, and losing it can feel like losing a close friend. Underneath the mask is all the hurt and fear we've been running from, hiding from. To let it come to the surface can shake us like an earthquake. Brad felt as if he was going to die. You may too. Or you may feel like Andy Gullihorn, who wrote the song Steel Bars from Old Hat. This is how it feels at the rock bottom of despair, when the house I built comes crashing down. And this is how it feels when I know the man that I say I am is not the man that I am when no one's around. But this is not the end of the road. It's the trailhead. What you are journeying towards is freedom, healing, and authenticity. Listen to the next part of Andy's song. This is how it feels to come alive again and start fighting back to gain control. And this is how it feels to let freedom in and break the chains that enslave my soul. As we walk away from the self, we will feel vulnerable and exposed. We will be sorely tempted to turn to our comforters for some relief, those places that we found solace and rest. Because so many of us turn to the woman for our sense of masculinity, we must walk away from her as well. I do not mean leave your wife. I mean you stop looking to her to validate you. Stop trying to make her come through for you. Stop trying to get your answer from her. For some men, this may mean disappointing her. If you've been a passive man, tiptoeing around your wife for years, never doing anything to rock the boat, then it's time to rock it. Stand up to her. Get her mad at you. For those of you violent men, including achievers, it means stop abusing her. You release her as the object of your anger because you release her as the one who was supposed to make you a man. Repentance for a driven man means you become kind. Both types are still going to the woman. Repentance depends on which way you've approached her. But I have counseled many young men to break up with the woman they were dating because they had made her their life. She was the sun of his universe around which he orbited. A man needs a much bigger orbit than a woman. He needs a mission, a life purpose, and he needs to know his name. Only then is he fit for a woman, for only then does he have something to invite her into. A friend tells me that in the Maasai tribe in Africa, a young man cannot court a woman until he has killed a lion. That's their way of saying until he has been initiated. I have seen far too many young men commit a kind of emotional promiscuity with a young woman. He will pursue her, not to offer his strength, but to drink from her beauty, to be affirmed by her, and to feel like a man. They will share deep, intimate conversations, but he will not commit. He is unable to commit. This is very unfair to the young lady. After a year of this sort of relationship, a dear friend said, "I never felt secure in what I meant to him." When we feel the pull toward the golden-haired woman, we must recognize that something deeper is at play. As Bly says, "What does it mean when a man falls in love with a radiant face across the room?" It may mean that he has some soul work to do. His soul is the issue. Instead of pursuing the woman and trying to get her alone, he needs to go alone himself, perhaps to a mountain cabin, for 3 months, write poetry, canoe down a river, and dream. That would save some women a lot of trouble. Again, this is not permission to divorce. A man who has married a woman has made her a solemn pledge. He can never heal his wound by delivering another to the one he promised to love. Sometimes she will leave him. That is another story. Too many men run after her, begging her not to go. If she has to go, it is probably because you have some soul work to do. What I am saying is that the masculine journey always takes a man away from the woman in order that he may come back to her with his question answered. A man does not go to a woman to get his strength. He goes to her to offer it. You do not need the woman for you to become a great man. And as a great man, you do not need the woman. As Augustine said, "Let my soul praise you for all these beauties, but let it not attach itself to them by the trap of love." The trap of addiction because we've taken our soul to her for validation. But there is an even deeper issue than our question. What else is it we are seeking from the woman with the golden hair? What is that ache we are trying to assuage with her? Mercy, comfort, beauty, ecstasy. In a word, God. I'm serious. What we are looking for is God. There was a time when Adam drank deeply from the source of all love. He, our first father and archetype, lived in an unbroken communion with the most captivating, beautiful, and intoxicating source of life in the universe. Adam had God. True, it was not good for man to be alone, and God in his humility gave us Eve, allowed us to need her as well. But something happened at the fall. Something shifted. Eve took the place of God in a man's life. Let me explain. Adam was not deceived by the serpent. Did you know that? Paul makes it clear in 1 Timothy 2:14. Adam did not fall because he was deceived. His sin was different. In some ways, it was more serious in that he did it with open eyes. We do not know how long it lasted, but there was a moment in Eden when Eve was fallen and Adam was not. She had eaten, but he yet had a choice. I believe something took place in his heart that went like this. I have lost my Ezer Konegdo, my soulmate, the most vital companion I've known. I do not know what life will be like, but I know I cannot live without her. Adam chose Eve over God. If you think I exaggerate, simply look around. Look at all the art, poetry, music, drama devoted to the beautiful woman. Listen to the language men use to describe her. Watch the powerful obsession at work. What else can this be but worship? Men come into the world without the God who was our deepest joy, our ecstasy. Aching for we know not what, we meet Eve's daughters, and we are history. She is the closest thing we've ever encountered, the pinnacle of creation, the very embodiment of God's beauty and mystery and tenderness and allure. And what goes out to her is not just our longing for Eve, but our longing for God as well. A man without his true love, his life, his God, will find another. What better substitute than Eve's daughters? Nothing else in creation even comes close. To a young man who had never been without a girlfriend since the 8th grade, I gave the advice that he should break up, call off all dating for 1 year. From the look on his face, you'd have thought I told him to cut off his arm, or something worse. Do you see what is at work here? Notice that the struggle with pornography or masturbation is most difficult when you are lonely or beat up or longing for comfort in some way. This will become more intense as you get closer to your wound. The longing for the ache to go away and the pull toward other comforters can seem overwhelming. I've watched it in many men. I know it in myself. But if this is the water you are truly thirsty for, then why do you remain thirsty after you've had a drink? It's the wrong well. We must reverse Adam's choice. We must choose God over Eve. We must take our ache to him. For only in God will we find the healing of our wound. Chapter 7. Healing the Wound. Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. You better let somebody love you before it's too late. The Eagles, from Desperado. The task of healing is to respect oneself as a creature, no more and no less. Wendell Berry. The deepest desire of our hearts is for union with God. God created us for union with himself. This is the original purpose of our lives. Brennan Manning. I think I've given you the wrong impression of my life with my sons. Rock climbing, canoeing, wrestling, our quest for danger and destruction. You might get the impression we're a sort of military academy of the backwoods or one of those militia cults. So let me tell you of my favorite event of the day. It comes late in the evening. At bedtime, after the boys have brushed their teeth and we've said our family prayers. As I'm tucking them in, one of my boys will ask, "Dad, can we snuggle tonight?" Snuggle time is when I'll cuddle up next to one of them on a bed that's not really big enough for both of us. And that's the point, to get very close. And there in the dark, we'll just sort of talk. Usually we start laughing and then we have to whisper because the others will ask us to keep it down in there. Sometimes it breaks into tickling, other times it's a chance for them to ask some serious questions about life. But whatever happens, what matters most is what's going on beneath all that. Intimacy. Closeness. Connection. Yes, my boys want me to guide them into adventure, and they love to test their strength against mine. But all of that takes place in the context of an intimate bond of love that is far deeper than words can express. What they want more than anything, what I love to offer them more than anything, is soul-to-soul oneness. As Tom Wolfe said, The deepest search in life, it seemed to me, the thing that in one way or another was central to all living, was man's search to find a father, not merely the father of his flesh, not merely the lost father of his youth, but the image of a strength and wisdom external to his need and superior to his hunger, to which the belief and power of his own life could be united. From the story of a novel. Guys are unanimously embarrassed by their emptiness and woundedness. It is, for most of us, a tremendous source of shame, as I've said. But it need not be. From the very beginning, back before the fall and the assault, ours was meant to be a desperately dependent existence. It's like a tree and its branches, explains Christ. You are the branches, I am the trunk. From me you draw your life. That's how it was meant to be. In fact, he goes on to say, apart from me, you can do nothing. John 15:5. He's not berating us or mocking us or even saying it with a sigh, all the while thinking, I wish they'd pull it together and stop needing me so much. Not at all. We are made to depend on God. We are made for union with him, and nothing about us works right without it. As C.S. Lewis wrote, a car is made to run on gasoline, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. This is where our sin and our culture have come together to keep us in bondage and brokenness, to prevent the healing of our wound. Our sin is that stubborn part inside that wants, above all else, to be independent. There's a part of us fiercely committed to living in a way where we do not have to depend on anyone, especially God. Then culture comes along with figures like John Wayne and James Bond and all those other real men. And the one thing they have in common is that they're loners. They don't need anyone. We come to believe deep in our hearts that needing anyone for anything is a sort of weakness, a handicap. This is why a man never, ever stops to ask for directions. I'm notorious for this. I know how to get there. I'll find my own way, thank you very much. Only when I am fully and finally and completely lost will I pull over and get some help, and I'll feel like a wimp for doing it. Jesus knew nothing of that. The man who never flinched to take on hypocrites and get in their face, the one who drove 100 men with a bundle of cords swung free, the master of wind and sea, lived in a desperate dependence on his Father. I assure you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He does only what he sees the Father doing. I live by the power of the living Father who sent me. The words I say are not my own, but my Father who lives in me does his work through me. This isn't a source of embarrassment to Christ. Quite the opposite. He brags about his relationship with his Father. He's happy to tell anyone who will listen, the Father and I are one. Why is this important? Because so many men I know live with a deep misunderstanding of Christianity. They look at it as a second chance to get their act together. They've been forgiven, now they see it as their job to get with the program. They're trying to finish the marathon with a broken leg. But follow this closely. You'll recall that masculinity is an essence that is passed from father to son. That is a picture, as so many things in life are, of a deeper reality. The true essence of strength is passed to us from God through our union with him. Notice what a deep and vital part of King David's life this is. Remembering that he is a man's man, a warrior for sure, listen to how he describes his relationship to God in the Psalms. I love you, O Lord, my strength. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O my strength, come quickly to help me. O my strength, I watch for you. You, O God, are my fortress, my loving God. I dare say that David could take on John Wayne or James Bond any day. Yet this true man is unashamed to admit his desperate dependence on God. We know we are meant to embody strength. We know we are not what we were meant to be. And so we feel our brokenness as a source of shame. As we spoke of his wound recently and how he needed to enter into it for healing, Dave protested, I don't even want to go there. It all feels so true. Men are typically quite harsh with the broken places within them. Many report feeling as though there is a boy inside, and they despise that about themselves. Quit being such a baby, they order themselves. But that is not how God feels. He is furious about what's happened to you. It would be better to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied around the neck than to face the punishment in store for harming one of these little ones. Luke 17:2. Think of how you would feel if the wounds you were given, the blows dealt to you, were dealt to a boy you loved, your son perhaps. Would you shame him for it? Would you feel scorn that he couldn't rise above it all? No, you'd feel compassion. As Gerald Manley Hopkins wrote, "My own heart, let me more have pity on. Let me live to my sad self hereafter kind." In the movie Good Will Hunting, there is a beautiful picture of what can happen when a man realizes he has owned his wound and discovers he doesn't have to. Will Hunting, played by Matt Damon, is a brilliant young man, a genius, who works as a janitor at MIT and lives in a rough part of town. No one knows about his gift because he hides it behind a false self of tough kid from the wrong side of the tracks. He's a fighter, a violent man. That false self was born out of a father wound. His original father he does not know, and the man who was his foster father would come home drunk and beat Will mercilessly. After he's arrested for getting into a brawl for the umpteenth time, Will is ordered by the court to see a psychologist, Sean, played by Robin Williams. They form a bond. For the first time in Will's life, an older man cares about him deeply. His initiation has begun. Toward the end of one of their last sessions, Sean and Will are talking about the beatings he endured, now recorded in his case file. Will. So, what is it like? Will has attachment disorder? Is it all that stuff? Fear of abandonment? Is that why I broke up with Skylar? Sean. I didn't know you had. I did. You want to talk about it? No. Hey, Will, I don't know a lot, but you see this? Holding his file. This is not your fault. Yeah, I know that. Look at me, son. It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault. I know. No, you don't. It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault. All right. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Don't mess with me, Sean. Not you. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. Will collapses into his arms, weeping. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It is no shame that you need healing. It is no shame to look to another for strength. It is no shame that you feel young and afraid inside. It's not your fault. Frederick Buechner's father committed suicide when he was 10. He left a note to his mother. I adore and love you, and am no good. Give Freddie my watch. Give Jamie my pearl pin. I give you all my love. And then he sat in the garage while the running car filled it with carbon monoxide. It happened on a Saturday morning in the fall. He was to have taken Frederick and his brother to a football game that day. Instead, he took himself forever from their lives. What is a 10-year-old boy to do with such an event? Buechner says in The Sacred Journey, "A child takes life as it comes because he has no other way of taking it. The world had come to an end that Saturday morning, but each time we had moved to another place, I had seen a world come to an end, and there had always been another world to replace it. When somebody you love dies," Mark Twain said, "it is like when your house burns down. It isn't for years that you realize the full extent of your loss. For me, it was longer than for most. If indeed I have realized it fully even yet. And in the meantime, the loss came to get buried so deep in me that after a time I scarcely ever took it out to look at it at all, let alone speak of it." This is the way we are with our wound, especially men. We bury it deep and never take it out again. But take it out we must, or better, enter into it. I entered my wound through the surprising door of my anger. After we moved to Colorado, about 11 years ago, I found myself snapping at my boys for silly things. A spilled glass of milk would elicit a burst of rage. "Whoa, John," I thought. "There are things going on inside. You'd better have a look under the hood." As I explored my anger with the help of my dear friend, Brent, I realized I was so furious about feeling all alone in a world that constantly demanded more of me than I felt able to give. Something in me felt young, like a 10-year-old boy in a man's world, but without a man's ability to come through. There was much fear beneath the surface, fear that I would fail, fear that I would be found out, and finally, fear that I was ultimately on my own. Where did all this fear come from, I wondered. Why do I feel so alone in the world and so young inside? Why does something in my heart feel orphaned? My answer came through several movies. As I've written about in other places, I was blindsided by A River Runs Through It, because through its beautiful retelling of boys who never really had their father except through their fishing trips, and how in the end they lost even that. I realized I had lost my father, and like Buechner, the loss got buried so deep in me that after a time I scarcely ever took it out. I was pierced by a perfect world because I saw there just how much a boy's father means to him and how I longed for that intimacy with a source of strength who loved me and could tell me my name. I so identified with Will Hunting because I, too, was a fighter who saw myself as up against the rest of the world, and I had also accepted my wound and never grieved it. I thought it was my fault. In some ways, God had to sneak up on me through those stories because I wasn't willing to just skip happily down the path to my heart's deepest pain. We fight this part of the journey. The whole false self, our lifestyle, is an elaborate defense against entering our wounded heart. It is a chosen blindness. Our false self stubbornly blinds each of us to the light and the truth of our own emptiness and hollowness, says Manning. There are readers who even now have no idea what their wound is, or even what false self arose from it. How convenient that blindness is, blissful ignorance. But a wound unfelt is a wound unhealed. We must go in. The door may be your anger. It may be rejection that you've experienced, perhaps from a girl. It may be failure or the loss of the golden bat and the way that God is thwarting your false self. It may be a simple prayer. Jesus, take me into my wound. Behold, he says, I stand at the door and knock. If you wanted to learn how to heal the blind and you thought that following Christ around and watching how he did it would make things clear, you'd wind up pretty frustrated. He never does it the same way twice. He spits on one guy. For another, he spits on the ground and makes mud and puts that on his eyes. To a third, he simply speaks. A fourth, he touches. And a fifth, he kicks out a demon. There are no formulas with God. The way in which God heals our wound is a deeply personal process. He is a person, and he insists on working personally. For some, it comes in a moment of divine touch. For others, it takes place over time and through the help of another, maybe several others. As Agnes Sanford says, there are in many of us wounds so deep that only the mediation of someone else to whom we may bear our grief can heal us. So much healing took place in my life simply through my friendship with Brent. We were partners, but far more than that, we were friends. We spent hours together fly fishing, backpacking, hanging out in pubs, just spending time with a man I truly respected, a real man who loved and respected me. Nothing heals quite like that. At first, I feared that I was fooling him, that he'd see through it any day and drop me. But he didn't, and what happened instead was validation. My heart knew that if a man I know as a man thinks I'm one too, well, then maybe I am one after all. Remember, masculinity is bestowed by masculinity. But there have been other significant ways in which God has worked. Times of healing prayer, times of grieving the wound and forgiving my father. Most of all, times of deep communion with God. The point is this. Healing never happens outside of intimacy with Christ. The healing of our wound flows out of our union with Him. But there are some common themes that I share with you as you seek the restoration of your heart. The first step seems so simple, it's almost hard to believe we overlook it, never ask for it, and when we do, we sometimes struggle for days just to get the words out. It begins with surrender. As Lewis says, until you have given yourself to Him, you will not have a real self. We return the branch to its trunk. We yield our lives to the One who is our life. And then we invite Jesus into the wound. We ask Him to come and meet us there, to enter into the broken and unhealed places of our heart. When the Bible tells us that Christ came to redeem mankind, it offers a whole lot more than forgiveness. To simply forgive a broken man is like telling someone running a marathon, "It's okay that you've broken your leg. I won't hold that against you. Now finish the race." That is cruel, to leave him disabled that way. No, there is much more to our redemption. The core of Christ's mission is foretold in Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release for the prisoners. The Messiah will come, he says, to bind up and heal, to release and set free. What? Your heart. Christ comes to restore and release you, your soul, the true you. This is the central passage in the entire Bible about Jesus, the one he chooses to quote about himself when he steps into the spotlight in Luke 4 and announces his arrival. So take him at his word. Ask him in to heal all the broken places within you and unite them into one whole and healed heart. Ask him to release you from all bondage and captivity, as he promised to do. As MacDonald prayed, "Gather my broken fragments to a whole. Let mine be a merry, all-receiving heart, but make it a whole, with light in every part." But you can't do this at a distance. You can't ask Christ to come into your wound while you remain far from it. You have to go there with him. That is why we must grieve the wound. It was not your fault, and it did matter. Oh, what a milestone day that was for me when I simply allowed myself to say that the loss of my father mattered. The tears that flowed were the first I'd ever granted my wound, and they were deeply healing. All those years of sucking it up melted away in my grief. It is so important for us to grieve our wound. It is the only honest thing to do. For in grieving, we admit the truth, that we were hurt by someone we loved, that we lost something very dear, and it hurts us very much. Tears are healing. They help to open and cleanse the wound. As Augustine wrote in his Confessions, "The tears streamed down, and I let them flow as freely as they would, making of them a pillow for my heart. On them it rested." Grief is a form of validation. It says the wound mattered. We let God love us. We let him get real close to us. I know, it seems painfully obvious, but I'm telling you, few men are ever so vulnerable as to simply let themselves be loved by God. After Brad lost his plan for redemption, I asked him, "Brad, why don't you just let God love you?" He squirmed in his chair. "I've had such a hard time with that, just being loved. It feels so naked. I'd rather be in control, be admired for what I bring to the group." Later, he wrote this in a letter to me. "After it all came crashing down, I was overwhelmed by sadness and grief. The pain is incredible. In the midst of that, God asked me, 'Brad, will you let me love you?' I know what he is asking. I feel anxious that I need to go email all these schools and secure a future. But I'm tired of running away. I want to come home." I flipped through my Bible and came to John 15. "Just as the Father has loved you, I have also loved you. Abide in my love." The battle is very intense. At times, it is all clear. At others, it is a fog. Right now, all I can do is cling to Jesus as best I know how and not run from all that is in my heart. Abiding in the love of God is our only hope, the only true home for our hearts. It's not that we mentally acknowledge that God loves us. It's that we let our hearts come home to him and stay in his love. MacDonald says it this way: "When our hearts turn to him, that is opening the door to him. Then he comes in, not by our thought only, not in our idea only, but he comes himself and of his own will. Thus the Lord, the Spirit, becomes the soul of our souls. Then indeed we are. Then indeed we have life. The life of Jesus has become life in us. We are one with God forever and ever." Or as St. John of the Cross echoes, "Oh, how gently and how lovingly dost thou lie awake in the depth and center of my soul, where thou in secret and in silence alone, as its sole Lord, abidest, not only as in thine own house or in thine own chamber, but also as within my own bosom, in close and intimate union." From Living Flame of Love. This deep, intimate union with Jesus and with his Father is the source of all our healing and all our strength. It is, as Leanne Payne says, the central and unique truth of Christianity. After a retreat in which I laid out the masculine journey to a small group of men, I received this email. "My father never left. He just never had time for me or words of encouragement. He has spent his entire life making himself the center of attention. For the first time, I understand why I am highly driven, why I never let anyone get close to me, including my wife, and why I am an imposter to most people. I broke down and cried. I feel the presence of God in my heart like I have never felt Him before. The beginning of a new heart. Time has come for us to forgive our fathers. Paul warns us that unforgiveness and bitterness can wreck our lives and the lives of others. I am sorry to think of all the years my wife endured the anger and bitterness that I redirected at her from my father. As someone has said, forgiveness is setting a prisoner free and then discovering the prisoner was you. I found some help in Bly's experience of forgiving his own father when he said, I began to think of him not as someone who had deprived me of love or attention or companionship, but as someone who himself had been deprived by his father and his mother and by the culture. My father had his own wound that no one ever offered to heal. His father was an alcoholic too, for a time, and there were some hard years for my dad as a young man, just as there were for me. Now, you must understand, forgiveness is a choice. It is not a feeling, but an act of the will. As Neil Anderson has written, don't wait to forgive until you feel like forgiving. You'll never get there. Feelings take time to heal after the choice to forgive is made. We allow God to bring the hurt up from our past, for if your forgiveness doesn't visit the emotional core of your life, it will be incomplete. We acknowledge that it hurt, that it mattered, and we choose to extend forgiveness to our Father. That is not saying it didn't really matter. It is not saying I probably deserved part of it anyway. Forgiveness says, it was wrong, it mattered, and I release you. And then we ask God to father us and to tell us our true name. I noticed a few years ago, a ways into my own masculine journey, that I related well to Jesus and to God, but not to God as Father. It's not hard to figure out why. Father has been a source of pain and disappointment to me, to many of us. Then I read this in MacDonald. In my own childhood and boyhood, my father was the refuge from all the ills of life, even sharp pain itself. Therefore, I say to son or daughter who has no pleasure in the name Father, you must interpret the word by all that you have missed in life, all that human tenderness can give or desire in the nearness and readiness of love, all and infinitely more must be true of the perfect Father, of the Maker of fatherhood. The gift was perfectly timed, for I knew it was time to allow God to father me. All along the process of my initiation, God has provided words like that, messages, people, gifts to open the next leg of the journey. Masculinity is passed from father to son, and then from father to son. Adam, Abraham, Jacob, David, Jesus. They all learned who they were out of their intimacy with God, with the Father. After all, who can give a man this, his own name? God alone. For no one but God sees what the man is. This is usually thought of with a sense of guilt. Yes, God sees me, and what he sees is my sin. That's wrong on two counts. First off, your sin has been dealt with. Your father has removed it from you as far as the east is from the west. Psalm 103:12. Your sins have been washed away. 1 Corinthians 6:11. When God looks at you, he does not see your sin. He has not one condemning thought toward you. Romans 8:1. But that's not all. You have a new heart. That's the promise of the new covenant. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Ezekiel 36:26-27. There's a reason that it's called good news. Too many Christians today are living back in the old covenant. They've had Jeremiah 17:9 drilled into them, and they walk around believing, my heart is deceitfully wicked. Not anymore, it's not. Read the rest of the book. In Jeremiah 31:33, God announces the cure for all that. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. I will give you a new heart. That's why Paul says in Romans 2:29, no, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart, by the Spirit. Sin is not the deepest thing about you. You have a new heart. Did you hear me? Your heart is good. What God sees when he sees you is the real you, the true you, the man he had in mind when he made you. How else could he give you the white stone with your true name on it? I brought you along in Dave's story, how his father dealt him the wound of Mama's boy, how he sought his sense of masculinity through women, how he embraced his wound and its message as final and true. We sat together one day in my office, his life pretty well detailed and unpacked before us, as if we had unpacked a trunk of secrets and laid them all out to the light of day. What else was there to say? You've only got one hope, Dave, that your dad was wrong about you. You must ask God what he thinks of you, and you must stay with the question until you have an answer. The battle will get fierce here. This is the last thing the evil one wants you to know. He will play the ventriloquist. He'll whisper to you as if he were the voice of God. Remember, he's the accuser of the brethren. Revelation 12:10. After I saw Gladiator, I so longed to be a man like Maximus. He reminded me of Henry V from Shakespeare's play, a courageous, valiant man. Maximus is strong and courageous, and he fights so well. Yet his heart is given over to eternity. He yearns for heaven, but stays to fight so that others might be free. I wept at the end, pierced by a longing to be like him. Satan was all over that, telling me that no, I was really Commodus, that conniving wretch who plays the villain in the movie. What made that blow so hard to shake is the fact that I once was Commodus. I was a selfish, conniving man who manipulated everything for my own benefit. That was a long time ago, but the accusation stung. I left for a trip to England where I did 4 conferences in 5 days. It was a brutal trip, and I was under a great deal of spiritual attack. What a relief it was to slump into my seat and catch my plane home. Tired to the bone, spent and beat up, I needed to hear words from my father. So I began to pour my heart out to him in my journal. What of me, dear Lord? Are you pleased? What did you see? I am sorry that I have to ask, wishing I knew without asking. Fear, I suppose, makes me doubt. Still, I yearn to hear from you a word or image, a name or even just a glance from you. This is what I heard. You are Henry V after Agincourt, the man in the arena whose face is covered with blood and sweat and wet and dust, who strove valiantly, a great warrior. Yes, even Maximus. And then, you are my friend. I cannot tell you how much those words mean to me. In fact, I'm embarrassed to tell them to you. They seem arrogant. But I share them in hopes that they will help you find your own. They are words of life, words that heal my wound and shatter the enemy's accusations. I am grateful for them, deeply grateful. Oh, what wondrous stories I could tell here of how many times God has spoken to me and to other men since we've been asking the question. My friend Aaron went to a park near our home and found a place of solitude. There, he waited for the Father's voice. What he first heard was this: true masculinity is spiritual. Aaron has for so long felt that spirituality was feminine. It put him in a terrible bind because he is a very spiritual man and yet longs to be a real man. God spoke exactly what he needed to hear. Masculinity is spiritual. Then he heard, true spirituality is good. And then, you are a man. You are a man. You are a man. It's a battle to get to this place, and once words like this have been spoken, the enemy rushes in to steal them. Remember how he assaulted Christ in the wilderness, right on the heels of hearing words from his father? Another friend and I were talking about these stories and many more like them. He sort of sighed and said, "Yes, I remember a time in church when I heard God say to me, 'You're doing great. I'm proud of you, right where you are.' But I could not believe it. It just doesn't seem true." That is why we always rest on propositional truth. We stand on what Scripture says about us. We are forgiven. Our heart is good. The Father's voice is never condemning. From that place, we ask God to speak personally to us, to break the power of the lie that was delivered with our wound. He knows your name. I have a favorite painting in my office, a reprint of Charlie Schrevogel's My Bunkie. It's a scene of 4 cavalry soldiers done in the Western style of Remington. The action is a rescue. One of the riders has apparently been shot off his horse, and 3 men are galloping in to pick him up. In the foreground, the stranded soldier is being swept up onto the back of the horse of his bunkmate, his bunkie. while the other two are providing rifle cover. I love this scene because that is what I want to do and be. I want to ride to the rescue of those who have been shot down. But sitting in my office one day, God began to speak to me about the painting and my role in it. You cannot be the man who rescues John until you are the man without a horse, the man who needs rescuing. Yes, true strength does not come out of bravado. Until we are broken, our life will be self-centered, self-reliant. Our strength will be our own. So long as you think you are really something in and of yourself, what will you need God for? I don't trust a man who hasn't suffered. I don't let a man get close to me who hasn't faced his wound. Think of the posers you know. Are they the kind of man you would call at 2 a.m. when life is collapsing around you? Not me. I don't want cliches. I want deep, soulful truth. And that only comes when a man has walked the road I've been talking about. As Buechner says, to do for yourself the best thing that you have it in you to do, to grit your teeth and clench your fists in order to survive the world at its harshest and worst, is, by that very act, to be unable to let something be done for you and in you that is more wonderful still. The trouble with steeling yourself against the harshness of reality is that the same steel that secures your life against being destroyed secures your life also against being opened up and transformed. Only when we enter our wound will we discover our true glory. As Bly says, where a man's wound is, that is where his genius will be. There are two reasons for this. First, because the wound was given in the place of your true strength as an effort to take you out. Until you go there, you are still posing, offering something more shallow and insubstantial. And therefore, second, it is out of your brokenness that you discover what you have to offer the community. The false self is never wholly false. Those gifts we've been using are often quite true about us, but we've used them to hide behind. We thought that the power of our life was in the golden bat, but the power is in us. When we begin to offer not merely our gifts, but our true selves, that is when we become powerful. That is when we are ready for battle. Chapter 8. A Battle to Fight. The Enemy. Enemy-occupied territory. That is what this world is. C.S. Lewis. We are but warriors for the working day. Our gayness and our guilt are all besmirched, with rainy marching in the painful field. But, by the mass, our hearts are in the trim. Henry V. If we would endeavor, like men of courage, to stand in the battle, surely we would feel the favorable assistance of God from heaven. For he who giveth us occasion to fight, to the end we may get the victory, is ready to succor those that fight manfully and do trust in his grace. Thomas A. Kempis. Dad, are there castles anymore? Luke and I were sitting at the breakfast table. Actually, he was seated and I was attending His Royal Highness, making him toast with apricot jam. As soon as he asked the question, I knew what his young heart was wondering. Are there any great adventures anymore? Are there any great battles? I wanted to explain that indeed there are, but before I could reply, he got this gleam in his eye and asked, "And are there any dragons?" Oh, how deeply this is written into the masculine soul. The boy is a warrior. The boy is his name. A man needs a battle to fight. He needs a place for the warrior in him to come alive and be honed, trained, seasoned. If Bly is right, and I believe he is, that the early death of a man's warriors keeps the boy in him from growing up, then the opposite is true. If we can reawaken the fierce quality in a man, hook it up to a higher purpose, release the warrior within, then the boy can grow up and become truly masculine. As I was working on this book a few days ago, Blaine came downstairs and without a word slipped a drawing he had made in front of me. It is a pencil sketch of an angel with broad shoulders and long hair. His wings are sweeping around him as if just unfurled to reveal that he is holding a large, two-handed sword like a Scottish claymore. He holds the blade upright, ready for action. His gaze is steady and fierce. Beneath the drawing are the words, written in the hand of a 9-year-old. Every man is a warrior inside, but the choice to fight is his own. And a little child shall lead them. Blaine knows as deeply as he knows anything that every man is a warrior, yet every man must choose to fight. The warrior is not the only role a man must play. There are others we will explore later. But the warrior is crucial in our movement toward any masculine integrity. It is hardwired into every man. I have in my files a copy of a letter written by Major Sullivan Ballou, a Union officer in the 2nd Rhode Island. He speaks to his wife on the eve of the Battle of Bull Run, a battle he senses will be his last. He speaks tenderly to her of his undying love, of the memories of blissful moments I have spent with you. Ballou mourns the thought that he must give up the hope of future years when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our sons grow up to honorable manhood around us. Yet, in spite of his love, the battle calls, and he cannot turn from it. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. How great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and sufferings of the Revolution. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. And yet, a greater cause comes over me like a strong wind and bears me unresistibly on with all these chains to the battlefield. A man must have a battle to fight, a great mission to his life that involves and yet transcends even home and family. He must have a cause to which he is devoted, even unto death, for this is written into the fabric of his being. Listen carefully now. You do. That is why God created you, to be his intimate ally, to join him in the great battle. You have a specific place in the line, a mission God made for you. That is why it is so essential to hear from God about your true name, because in that name is the mission of your life. Churchill was called upon to lead the British through the desperate hours of World War II. He said, I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. The same is true for you. Your whole life has been preparation. I'd love to be William Wallace, leading the charge with a big sword in my hand, sighed a friend. But I feel like I'm the guy back there in the fourth row, with a hoe. That's a lie of the enemy, that your place is really insignificant, that you aren't really armed for it anyway. In your life, you are William Wallace. Who else could be? There is no other man who can replace you in your life in the arena you've been called to. If you leave your place in the line, it will remain empty. No one else can be who you are meant to be. You are the hero in your story, not a bit player, not an extra, but the main man. This is the next leg in the initiation journey, when God calls a man forward to the front lines. He wants to develop and release in us the qualities every warrior needs, including a keen awareness of the enemies we will face. Above all else, a warrior has a vision. He has a transcendence to his life, a cause greater than self-preservation. The root of all our woes and our false self was this. We were seeking to save our life, and we lost it. Christ calls a man beyond that. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Mark 8:35. Again, this isn't just about being willing to die for Christ. It's much more daily than that. For years, all my daily energy was spent trying to beat the trials in life and arrange for a little pleasure. My weeks were wasted away either striving or indulging. I was a mercenary. A mercenary fights for pay, for his own benefit. His life is devoted to himself. The quality of a true warrior, says Bly, is that he is in service to a purpose greater than himself, that is, to a transcendent cause. That is the moving quality in Ballou's letter. That is the secret of the warrior heart of Jesus. Second, a warrior is cunning. He knows when to fight and when to run. He can sense a trap and never charges blindly ahead. He knows what weapons to carry and how to use them. Whatever specific terrain you are called to, at home, at work, in the realm of the arts or industry or world politics, you will always encounter three enemies: the world, the flesh, and the devil. They make up sort of an unholy trinity. Because they always conspire together, it's a bit difficult to talk about them individually. In any battle, at least two of them are involved, but usually it's all three. Still, they each have their own personality, so I'll take them one at a time and then try to show how they collude against us. Let's start with the enemy closest at hand, the traitor within. John Owen says in Sin and Temptation, however strong a castle may be, if a treacherous party resides inside, ready to betray at the first opportunity possible. The castle cannot be kept safe from the enemy. Traitors occupy our own hearts, ready to side with every temptation and to surrender to them all. Ever since that fateful day when Adam gave away the essence of his strength, men have struggled with a part of themselves that is ready at the drop of a hat to do the same. We don't want to speak up unless we know it will go well, and we don't want to move unless we're guaranteed success. What the scriptures call the flesh, the old man, or the sinful nature, is that part of fallen Adam in every man that always wants the easiest way out. It's much easier to masturbate than to make love to your wife, especially if things are not well between you and initiating sex with her feels risky. It's much easier to go down to the driving range and attack a bucket of balls than it is to face the people at work who are angry at you. It's much easier to clean the garage, organize your files, cut the grass, or work on the car than it is to talk to your teenage daughter. To put it bluntly, your flesh is a weasel, a poser, and a selfish pig. And your flesh is not you. Did you know that? Your flesh is not the real you. When Paul gives us his famous passage on what it's like to struggle with sin in Romans 7, he tells a story we are all too familiar with. I decide to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyway. My decisions, such as they are, don't result in actions. Something has gone wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. It happens so regularly that it's predictable. The moment I decide to do good, sin is there to trip me up. I truly delight in God's commands, but it's pretty obvious that not all of me joins in that delight. Parts of me covertly rebel, and just when I least expect it, they take charge. Okay, we've all been there many times, but what Paul concludes is just astounding. I am not really the one doing it. The sin within me is doing it. Romans 7:20. Did you notice the distinction he makes? Paul says, hey, I know I struggle with sin, but I also know that my sin is not me. This is not my true heart. You are not your sin. Sin is no longer the truest thing about the man who has come into union with Jesus. Your heart is good. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. Ezekiel 36:26. The big lie in the church today is that you are nothing more than a sinner saved by grace. You are a lot more than that. You are a new creation in Christ. The New Testament calls you a saint, a holy one, a son of God. In the core of your being, you are a good man. Yes, there is a war within us, but it is a civil war. The battle is not between us and God. No, there is a traitor within who wars against our true heart, fighting alongside the Spirit of God in us. A new power is in operation. The Spirit of life in Christ, like a strong wind, has magnificently cleared the air, freeing you from a fated lifetime of brutal tyranny at the hands of sin and death. Anyone, of course, who has not welcomed this invisible but clearly present God, the Spirit of Christ, won't know what we're talking about. But for you who welcomed him, in whom he dwells, if the alive and present God who raised Jesus from the dead moves into your life, he'll do the same thing in you that he did in Jesus. When God lives and breathes in you, and he does as surely as he did in Jesus, you are delivered from that dead life. Romans 8:2-3 and 9-11. The real you is on the side of God against the false self. Knowing this makes all the difference in the world. The man who wants to live valiantly will lose heart quickly if he believes that his heart is nothing but sin. Why fight? The battle feels lost before it even begins. No, your flesh is your false self, the poser, manifest in cowardice and self-preservation, and the only way to deal with it is to crucify it. Now, follow me very closely here. We are never, ever told to crucify our heart. We are never told to kill the true man within us, never told to get rid of those deep desires for battle and adventure and beauty. We are told to shoot the traitor. How? Choose against him every time you see him raise his ugly head. Walk right into those situations you normally run from. Speak right to the issues you normally remain silent over. If you want to grow in true masculine strength, then you must stop sabotaging yours. Sabotage. Rich is a deeply passionate young man who is really trying to learn what it means to be a man. A few weeks ago, he had plans to go out with some friends. They promised to call him before they left and then come pick him up. They never called. A few days later, when one of them brought it up, Rich said, "Oh, that's okay, it's no big deal." But inside, he was furious. That is sabotage. He deliberately chose to push his true strength down and live the false self. Do that enough, and you won't believe you have any strength. I've noticed when I deny the anger I'm feeling, it turns into fear. If we will not allow what Sam Keen calls fire in the belly, something weaker will take its place. I had a chance a few years back to tell my boss what I really thought of him. Not in sinful anger, there's a difference. Not to hurt him, but to help him. He actually asked me to, called to see if I was free to chat for a moment. I knew what he was calling for, and I ran. I told him I was busy. For days afterward, I felt weak. I felt like a poser. I sabotaged my strength by refusing it. Sabotage also happens when we give our strength away. Taking a bribe, letting yourself be bought off, accepting flattery in exchange for some sort of loyalty is sabotage. Refusing to confront an issue because if you keep quiet, you'll get a promotion or be made an elder or keep your job corrupts you down deep. Masturbation is sabotage. It is an inherently selfish act that tears you down. I've spoken with many men whose addiction to masturbation has eroded their sense of strength. So does sexual involvement with a woman you're not married to. Carl is another young man whom the ladies seem to find especially attractive. I am astounded what young women will offer when they are famished for the love and affirmation they have never had from their fathers. They will throw themselves at a man to get a taste of being wanted, desired. Carl came to me because his sexual activity was out of control. Dozens upon dozens of women offered themselves to him, and each time he gave in, he felt weakened. His resolve to resist was less the next time around. Things began to change for Carl when he saw the whole sexual struggle, not so much as sin, but as a battle for his strength. He wants to be strong, wants it desperately, and that began to fuel his choice to resist. As Akempis said, "A man must strive long and mightily within himself before he can learn fully to master himself." Carl and I spent hours praying through every one of those relationships, confessing the sin, breaking the bonds sexual liaisons form between two souls, cleansing his strength, asking God to restore him. He did, and I'm grateful to say that those days are over for Carl. It wasn't easy, but it was real. He is happily married now. The real thing. Start choosing to live out of your strength, and you'll discover that it grows each time. Rich was after some brakes for his car. He called the parts store and they quoted him a price of $50 for the pair. But when he got down there, the guy told him it would be $90. He was taking Rich for a fool, and something in Rich was provoked. Normally, he would have said, "Oh, that's okay, it's no big deal," and paid the higher price. But not this time. He told the guy that the price was $50 and stood his ground. The guy backed down and stopped trying to rip him off. "It felt great," Rich told me later. "I felt that I was finally acting like a man." Now, that may seem like a simple story, but this is where you will discover your strength in the daily details of your life. Begin to taste your true strength, and you'll want more. Something in the center of your chest feels weighty, substantial. We must let our strength show up. It seems so strange, after all this, that a man would not allow his strength to arrive. But many of us are unnerved by our own masculinity. What will happen if we really let it out? In Healing the Masculine Soul, Gordon Dalby tells a remarkable story about a man who was plagued by a recurring dream, a nightmare in which a ferocious lion kept chasing the man until he dropped exhausted and awoke screaming. The man was dismayed. He did not know what the dream meant. Was the lion a symbol of fear? Something in his life overwhelming him? One day the man was guided by his pastor, a friend of Dalby's, to revisit the dream in prayer. As they prayed, the pastor on impulse invited the man to recall the dream, even in all its fear. Hesitantly, the man agreed, and soon reported that indeed, the lion was in sight and headed his way. The pastor then instructed the man, "When the lion comes close to you, try not to run away, but instead, stand there and ask him who or what he is and what he's doing in your life. Can you try that?" Shifting uneasily in his chair, the man agreed, then reported what was happening. The lion is snorting and shaking his head, standing right there in